Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Nearly 200 years ago, Isambard Kingdom Brunel was at the forefront of an infrastructure revolution. The aim was to meet the challenges of his age. But what do we do now in a climate emergency, an ever-changing world? Well, let's go beyond Brunel and discuss how we can shape the region between now and 2050. I'm Christopher Ackland, a civil engineer living and working in the Southwest, and I'll be posing key questions to infrastructure leaders and industry experts throughout this podcast series. For this episode, we'll be talking about the infrastructure we need and how we can achieve it. Forget excuses or obstacles, we'll be focusing on enabling change and breaking down barriers to progress. My guests in the studio today are David Carter, Deputy Director of Economic and Community Infrastructure and Commissioning at Somerset County Council, and Miranda Housden, IC Southwest Director and Secretary of the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership. And online joining me are Colin Taylor, Emeritus Professor of Earthquake Engineering at the University of Bristol, an ICE Policy Fellow for Subnational Decarbonisation and Southwest Infrastructure Partnership Steering Group Member. And also online, Tom Whitmore, Managing Director at Geomarine in Guernsey. Welcome to all of my guests. Let's start with a big question. What do you think infrastructure will look like in 2050? You can be visionary or pragmatic in answering this. It's entirely up to you. David, please start us off.
So perhaps I'll start with what I hope infrastructure will be like in 2050. And I hope we have achieved net zero by 2050. I also hope that the additional infrastructure we've built since 2022 into 2050 has been really considered in the round with an environmental consequences and the climate consequences in mind. We've only added physical infrastructure where it's been deemed to be absolutely necessary. So I hope that's the future. And I hope that part of quite a lot of it is using the current infrastructure we have in a better way to its optimum. And I think that will require both behavioural change and some brave decisions from government, because it means that the way that we have to interact with, perhaps the way we have to pay for it and perhaps the way it's funded has to change. So that's what I hope will happen.
So I guess it's a piece around sort of using what we've already got rather than building entirely new. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I think judicious additional infrastructure is clearly required. But there is a limit, and there's an environmental limit to any country. We possibly have already well exceeded our environmental limit with the amount of infrastructure we have, given the population size we have. We can't feed ourselves from our own landmass, so we will have to import food. I think my recollection is that that happened sometime in sort of the 1920s when we flipped over. So we had almost 100 years of accepting that we had to import grain, for example, from the rest of the world. Now, whilst that's fine, you've seen with the recent events in global politics that that's quite a risk, and again, for our energy supplies to come in. So I hope that we're broadly self-sufficient, certainly in energy, and our infrastructure has been optimised. And I think, hopefully, our daily lives are not that much different. It's just perhaps we just have a different behaviour. And actually, the public as a whole has in mind the environmental and ecological consequences of our existence. That is broadly what the challenge of the next 28 years is, I think.
And of course, there's a big piece around sort of environmental awareness now, and I think everybody's got an appreciation of, you know, safeguarding our assets, but equally doing so in a much more considered manner. And so, Colin, I'm conscious that we, as part of the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, you've helped to produce a net zero route map. And I wonder, just to get your thoughts on where we might head in 2050.
Infrastructure itself won't necessarily have changed hugely by 2050. But we also need to recognise that net zero isn't just for 2050. It's forever. So really, 2050 is a waypoint on our journey towards delivering decarbonised infrastructure in perpetuity. So I think for me, the biggest thing is that we will view infrastructure and its vital role in the way our society works. We'll view it in a very different way to the way we look at it now. We will really have improved our understanding about how people use infrastructure services to generate their own life outcomes, and we will have worked out how to tailor those services so that they promote more effective decarbonized behaviors. I'm seeing the next 30 years or so as being a really exciting time. I'd love to be a 30-year-old engineer again, because there's some fantastic challenges to work through, to really transform the way in which we deliver infrastructure into the long term.
And I guess sort of having that foresight is really important. And I just want to bring Miranda in here because, of course, Miranda is part of your role as IC Southwest Director and Secretary with SWIP. I guess you're talking to an awful lot of people across the region, an awful lot of stakeholders. But, you know, how do you think we bring people together to focus on what we need?
Well, I think we really don't know what we need in 2050. And we all have great aspirations for what's going to be there. But in reality, it might have to be something very different. And trying to bring communities along with us to make sure that they have the services that they need and can have their day-to-day lives impacted as little as possible, we've got to do some serious working together to make that happen. And we need engineers who are really creative and adaptable to be able to make that happen.
And equally, I suppose, environmentalists and all sorts of infrastructure professionals. And I suppose maybe this is a bit of a call to arms, isn't it, to the next generation almost, to seize the challenge. And although, of course, it's not very far away, 2050, you know, many budding engineers and scientists and environmentalists will be, you know, learning about climate change and sort of identifying the needs or aspirations, I suppose. And maybe it's part of our plan is to get them up to speed and thinking about these challenges.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that we created the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, was because it's bringing together such a wide range of people who are interested in infrastructure and the needs of the Southwest, and really coming up with some very creative thinking around that.
Fantastic. And Tom, I want to bring you in now. So I'm just thinking, if there's one thing that you could do to improve infrastructure on a regional level, or maybe we start with a sort of broader approach and then we go down into the Southwest, the Peninsula, Guernsey, what would it be that you would want to see happening between now and 2050?
It's not necessarily an entirely new set of infrastructure, but an entirely new way of thinking about infrastructure, I think, should be the primary objective. Clearly, we need to replace aging end-of-life infrastructure and replace that with more intelligent infrastructure, and one that considers sustainability kind of in the round better than we have in the past. But what we'd like to see is us thinking about that in an entirely new way, thinking about the horizon that we build that infrastructure for and the effects on kind of the future generations. What I wouldn't want to see is an entirely new set of infrastructure or replacement infrastructure almost unnecessarily. I think that one of the things that we have a problem with is kind of this concept of replacing things, growth, and the consumerist kind of attitude that it pervades, not necessarily infrastructure, but more broadly. And it's about getting away from that.
You've hit an important point there, and I did want to pick up on one of those points that you mentioned, and it's this piece around sort of carbon and social value, and equally, I guess, a make, do and mend approach. I mean, I think probably make, do and mend was probably frowned upon, but actually, you know, maybe that's our way forward going into the future and bringing in some of those carbon and social value aspects alongside that.
Yeah, I think that make, do and mend, it's important to utilise assets for as long as they can and be intelligent about how we maintain them. One of the things that I think we're not particularly good at is maintaining our infrastructure. In my opinion, both kind of economically and wider in terms of sustainability, it is better to keep on top of your infrastructure maintenance. It's something that I kind of go on about quite regularly. I run a civil engineering contract, and unfortunately, I get often a fairly, people think that I'm saying this because I'm trying to generate work for contractors. It's not. It's, the reality is that it is better to maintain and keep on top of the maintenance of infrastructure economically and sustainability, rather than letting things degrade and then replacing them wholesale. So I'm quite passionate about keeping on top of infrastructure. I think that unless you've got a realistic prospect of replacing that piece of infrastructure with something better, or not needing that piece of infrastructure anymore, just keep on top of maintaining it. Ultimately, we'll get to a point where old pieces of infrastructure are no longer suitable for their use, and or they are inefficient in terms of their footprint kind of socially and in terms of carbon. And at that point, of course, it's appropriate to replace.
And presumably, David, you have an awful lot of infrastructure to look after. And so is it a challenge or an opportunity, or perhaps both?
I think just taking local roads, for example, there's a lot of discussion about decarbonisation, a lot of understanding about things that need to decarbonise. But until recently, the government hadn't really focused on local highways decarbonisation. It is the biggest emitter of carbon from any local authority activity. So looking at that, and I agree exactly what Tom's saying, focusing on that and using decarbonisation, and in effect, the mandate that gives you to say, how can we maintain this existing infrastructure, both in a way that it lasts longer, because the two things could be co-termini, decarbonisation and whole life assets. And by 2050, as Colin was saying, that's where we want to get to, that we have a method and a system of maintenance that is zero carbon. At the moment, people would be quite horrified to how many thousand tons of CO2 just in maintaining roads. And I think the optimum level of funding for that is probably slightly higher than it is at the moment, maybe not much higher. The government has done a very good job over the last 15 years of bringing in asset management to local highway network. This is something that everybody uses. Most people use a street or a road every day. And that's the kind of infrastructure I was saying, how do we use that in the future? It's always going to be there. I think we've made the point, how do you use that better? And I think that we also have a job to do to educate everybody in the round, not just to climate change, but all the things that we do that contribute towards it that perhaps people don't quite see. And again, it's not saying to people and demonising them for not doing it. It's just making them aware of, we need to make this change, and this is a really difficult issue. You might need to pay a bit more to ensure that we can achieve net zero, because that's looking after ourselves in the long term. So hopefully that answers that question.
And I think it leads on to this point on sort of behavioural change versus policy change, doesn't it? And perhaps, Colin, your views on what's more important, or again, is it a mixture of both? Is it policy change or behavioural change?
Net zero is an outcome of how we choose to behave, and our behaviours are shaped by the infrastructure services that we provide. So behaviour is at the core of it. Now, we're not good at understanding the connection between human behaviour, things that we choose to do, and how our infrastructure works and shapes those behaviours. So it's really crucial that we improve the way in which we do engineering so that we really put end user behavior right at the heart of our solutions. Now, policy is a very important step along the way to satisfying and shaping decarbonized behaviors, alongside, I would say, improving other societal outcomes. The decarbonisation net zero cuts across everything that we do. So we've got a fantastic opportunity to address things like social inequity and other societal challenges through driving into the net zero challenge. And indeed, I don't believe we will achieve net zero if we don't also address those other challenges in parallel. So it's a huge problem. Sitting also at the heart of the problem, the way or the solutions, is understanding that we've got to redesign the value chains that enable us to marshal our resources to create better infrastructure solutions. And there's an extended value chain, which actually starts with understanding our purpose. And net zero now is a pretty well-defined purpose. And then policy frames that and empowers people to invest in developing the solutions. That could be a financial investment, it could be a personal investment in terms of your own work and contributions to it. But policy is about empowerment ultimately. And we've got to make sure that that policy is properly joined up across the many different societal outcomes that government is trying to achieve. Because if we get it wrong in one area, we can actually undermine successful decarbonisation solutions in other areas.
And just to pick up on that, Colin, just for our listeners, just explain what you mean by value chain.
For something to happen, it involves a lot of collaboration between many different people, organisations, businesses, and so on. And each business in that chain is trying to create more value from the investment, the financial investment that it's putting into its activities. Crudely, it's trying to make a profit or a surplus on its investment. And in creating its bit of value in that chain, it passes that on to the next person or the next organization in that chain, who then adds their bit to it. And it's, so it progresses through the whole thing.
Thank you, Colin. And I just want to draw on something. You know, we can't ignore the government's Levelling Up Fund and, of course, the white paper, which was produced in 2022 in February. And the Institution of Civil Engineers have published a policy position statement saying that regional and local social needs must first be identified before infrastructure interventions can be made. And Miranda, I just wanted to pick your brain, really. And, you know, with your regional cap on, do you think people really understand what we need in terms of local social needs?
Well, we really do need to have some local needs assessment, but we just need to find out exactly what the right solutions are at a local level. And we probably need extra funding to do that. But we know that ADEPT and all the local authorities are trying to make this happen, but it's difficult when you don't have the funding to go that extra step.
Could you explain what ADEPT means and what role they're playing in infrastructure in the Southwest?
They are place directors who are all directors within the Southwest at a local authority level, and it stands for the Association of Directors of Environment, Economy, Planning and Transport.
I suppose so. There's a lot of thinking going on here, but I suppose what we're really trying to nail down as part of this podcast series is how do we move forward? And we have the right minds together. So how do we progress? What do we need to do now and in the future? And how do we change? And perhaps, Tom, I can bring you in again on that.
So if I could change one thing, it would not be a physical infrastructure thing, referring back to kind of the previous answer about the way we think about it. We've touched a couple of times about cost and funding. David talked about paying a little bit more for infrastructure and infrastructure maintenance. Miranda just referred to funding there. One of the problems I think that we've got is the way that we write business cases for pieces of infrastructure at the minute, and more widely, kind of our economic model generally. I think what we need to be doing is looking at the cost of not investing in this stuff properly, rather than we heavily focus on measuring our economy in terms of GDP. We've got to focus on growth, which I think has negative aspects in terms of sustainability. What we need to do is move towards thinking about it more widely than that, thinking about kind of concept I really like at the minute, which is wealth accounting, and talking about our effect on eroding our natural resources by not reinvesting in infrastructure carefully. Then when you look at it that way, it makes it a lot easier to justify investment once you take into account the kind of the cost of all the natural capital that we consume.
Yeah, and we also need to understand the inequalities a lot more than we do.
And in terms of those inequalities, is that a case of being a more isolated community? Is it a case of being more rural? Is there one thing we can pinpoint, or is it a broader, more complex situation than that?
Yeah, well, it is complex, but in the Southwest, we have such disparity between the rural communities and those living in cities like Bristol or Bath. It's just so different, and we just need to be able to support people in the rural communities a lot more than we can at the moment.
And of course, it's, I suppose, Bristol is our biggest city in the region. And I don't know about you, it often seems like sort of, I suppose, levelling up and an infrastructure might stop at the M5 and it perhaps doesn't go any further. So, David, how do we consider the region as a whole and not just cities? How do we break down those barriers?
Yeah, so I think, again, this comes back to a very simple case of getting evidence to say, our objective is to level up, if that's what our objective is. What is the evidence? What are the disparities? What are those measures? And to be fair to the government, they had a lot of measures in the 12 pillars of levelling up that they put forward. Whether or not the distribution of money that goes with it, and first of all, the money, it's not insignificant, but it's clearly, and it's never enough. All governments always struggle to fund things to the extent where they actually would change things for most people. That's the difficulty in the world we live in. So I think that the evidence base would tell you across the Southwest, why does a certain community, what is it that another community has? Now, the other thing I'd say is that the logic which we used to have, that the clustering of peoples, the clustering of knowledges, and hence why cities, certainly through the early parts of this century, the cities and the densification of cities and putting in transport networks and infrastructure networks to serve that. And if you like to accelerate that economy that you had, the knowledge economy, perhaps what the pandemic's shown us, and we're sitting here with two people remotely, is that that doesn't necessarily need to be the case. And that question mark, does it? We're social animals. Will we always end up congregating in large numbers? And by default of that, that's where you get your added value, you get your highest value, where you've got concentrations of people who are skilled and talented, and Bristol's a good example of that. So I don't know. And my point is evidence. Watch what happens. Let's just see what happens to that. Maybe there's a case of it's actually where you are in your life. You go and congregate into cities when you're younger. You get your years of experience, you get your education, and then actually the ability to congregate, which digital infrastructure has given us, is perhaps in that life. So that might be a way of looking at it, but you'd need evidence to say.
But have we got time? I suppose that's the next question is, you know, in order to build that evidence base, presumably we need time, but actually we need to almost act now, don't we?
Yeah, so I think the point is the evidence base is about levelling up, not necessarily where you put your infrastructure. So levelling up is a myriad of different measures for what does it mean. That was a question the public asked when it was first there. But it broadly means, in my understanding of it, giving everybody a similar opportunity, the best opportunity they can, but making it a relatively level opportunity across the country. Where you have, at the moment, performance in schools, for example, that's very good in London. They spent a lot of money in London getting secondary schools in London and certainly state schools to be there. So again, that was something where you'd say, okay, how do you level up? because if you give people the same educational opportunities, perhaps then that's part of levelling up. So my point, Chris, is that I'm not sure infrastructure and levelling up are one and the same thing. Unfortunately, quite a lot of levelling up fund has gone towards infrastructure projects, be they town centres and urban realms. And that's another question about how does our economy function? So I think your point about time, we will change. Society always has changed. We as engineers, I think, just have to be aware, particularly in the southwest, of what is our particular circumstances. And there is a bit where you can push change in a certain direction by using infrastructure investment to do it. You've just got to be sure. So I take Tom's point. This is about what do you want as an outcome in the business case? It can't be just that old growth model, which was using land, putting more houses on it, increasing population. That is not sustainable. But you could theoretically have GDP growth without using finite resources. We just haven't quite found a way in the new economy of doing that yet. And I think that's the challenge of our times.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
Okay, so off the back of COVID-19 and the rapid change in the way that we work, the way that we live, the way that we engage with others, Colin, I'd like to ask you, is the need for digitalisation still there going forward?
Yes, absolutely. Digitalisation was always going to happen. There are lots of benefits that will accrue from it. What the pandemic has done is really accelerate people's transition to digital ways of working. So it's one of those things where the more power that the digital infrastructure offers, people will find very creative ways of using it. Things that we can't think of at the moment, but when the more powerful digital networks are in place, people will come up with very clever ways of using it. And in doing so, providing we've got a net zero mindset underpinning everything, then that can improve the way in which we can achieve net zero. So I think, yes, we do need this investment. And we've got to be very careful that we don't constrain ourselves by sort of anchoring ourselves in the past, whereas in fact, we need to anchor ourselves in the future.
I think we are social animals. And I think that ultimately there is a time and a place where we should continue to congregate and interact one-to-one. And there's all sorts of stuff around that, around our mental health and productivity. But I think that what we need to make sure is that it doesn't cause even more inequality. It's easy, of course, to deploy the fast broadband in the population centres. And then all that does is cause, at the very least in the short term, greater inequality between urban and rural areas. And so I think it's important that the investment is the easy thing to do, of course, if you're the one paying for that, is to connect the most number of people at the front end of that project and show progress in that way. I think that we need to make sure that that investment is focused with levelling up in mind, as well as just sort of pushing the boundaries of what connectivity we have.
Fantastic, thank you. And Miranda, I'd like to bring you in again. So if you had the power to do one single thing to improve infrastructure in the Southwest for both people and planet, what would it be and why?
I think the best thing that could happen would be to inspire young people to want to be civil engineers and to want to do something really creative and productive for the environment. And I think we need to be thinking in very different ways. So we need that diversity in the profession that isn't currently there. And we need to be bringing that in now because of the time it takes to create infrastructure. So we need young people now wanting to be civil engineers and understanding what an amazing career it is.
Fantastic. You showed it to me. And so we've spoken a lot about the needs and what we need to do in the future, but perhaps not so much about how we do that, the implementation. So, David, how do we achieve all of this?
If you look at it from on public sector, so the structure of how does government deliver it between central and local government and agencies? And I think that something that SWIP's done, and it's a good model, is some regional coordination. I hesitate to use the word regional planning because that has connotations from the past, but regional coordination of what's important. And I think getting together to say, okay, there's a limited amount of money, but what do we target to do? And I'll give you an example. In terms of decarbonising transport, it is obvious that cities probably lend themselves to easier decarbonisation than rural areas. So have a look at that. And again, when government asks local authorities to do something and says, hey, this is mandated to do it, it's much easier for local politicians to, in effect, to implement that. If you give the choice to local politicians, that's then difficult. So the government has worked this out. It's done this quite well in other fields. So I think that's where regional coordination to implement and us to come together to say, okay, these are our priorities to government. The fractured nature of funding and the fractured nature of delivery makes delivering to 2050 quite difficult. And I think in some senses, it does need to come together, whether that's done voluntarily across the Southwest region or whether it's coerced by government, I'll leave you to ponder.
And so do you think, though, it requires a bottom-up approach? Is that the way forward, you know, from the ground up, that we need to push these?
I would say a bit of both. If the government said the mandate was to say, OK, here's, you know, 5-10 years of planning. This is another thing. We tend to think of 5-10 years plan as some sort of Stalinist approach to planning. But given how long these things take, and Colin was saying about, if you like, the length of investment in period for infrastructure, 5-10 years is probably one cycle. And what is it we're going to do? Government has a limited amount of funding, but it splits up. We spend an awful lot of time and energy trying to get the limited amount of funding there. If we spent less energy trying to get a little amount of funding and coordinated it better, coordinated with private sector investment as well, we'd probably achieve net zero by 2050. Not easily, but not quite. I think my sense is that sometime in the next 10, 15 years, there's going to be a mad panic that we're not on target. And that's going to be very difficult. And I think that some additional coordination, and I think the ICE is doing that, that's exactly what SWIP's trying to do, but it's trying to get, if you like, the public sector side of it around that to say, okay, we need to focus on these priorities and get this change to implement it.
And Miranda, just to bring you in again, I guess in terms of implementation, you might be coming at this from a slightly different perspective, perhaps a broader scale, joining up the dots, bringing people together as part of a sort of more collaborative approach. But is it also about skills, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's both, Chris. And in terms of bringing people together, we have an awards system where we bring everyone together for, you know, in terms of best practice, where they share at an annual ceremony. They're sharing all the amazing projects that have been taking place across the Southwest. And everyone's learning from each other. They're seeing the films, how it's being made. And it's a really exciting time to discover exactly what different groups of people have been achieving.
Fantastic. And Tom, in terms of implementation, from your perspective, how do we go forward?
I think that net zero is viewed as a cost and viewed as taking risks on new technologies. And I think that we need to change that mindset. I think we need to get people thinking more positively about it. It goes kind of back to the way we think about our economy, our business case. And I think we need to change that mindset. That's at every level, policy level kind of leads it. But then equally, to pick up on a point that David mentioned there about democracy, we need to get it across to every person to make sure that they're taking this seriously when they're exercising their democratic rights. We need to get to a point where we change that kind of thought environment and the culture, so that these brilliant people that Miranda referred to are coming to university now that really are going to need to solve these problems in the future, that we have provided by then the right environment for them to be able to kind of utilise these skills and solve these problems.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of families just have no idea what civil engineering is and the impact it's having on their daily life. And that's something, as both ICE and the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, we have an opportunity to get them to have a greater understanding. And there's all sorts of amazing programmes on the TV which will tell you more, but they don't really appreciate the fact that it's covering everything from water and waste and transport, energy. Is just so much that's affecting them. And then I think people don't really believe that they have an opportunity to have any connection to making change. And I think that's something we want to give a better understanding of, that they can.
And of course, I suppose people are more connected if they feel they can contribute. Colin, implementation, how do we do it?
One of the important aspects of the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership's route map is the notion of using the Southwest as what's called a living laboratory. It's studying how infrastructure works, how people use infrastructure work in place, in situ. So, for example, one of the things that SWIP is hoping to set up is a study with citizens of a market town in Gloucestershire to really explore the question, what's stopping them from moving to a decarbonized transport? What's stopping them buying an electric vehicle? Because that's an example which has huge ramifications for infrastructure, not just the road system, but all the electrical power system, to make sure it's strong enough to take all the extra charge points and so on. But also there are the huge behavioural aspects. You know, people have to come to a decision point where they decide to spend their hard-earned money on buying an electric vehicle. So what we want to do is work with local citizens to explore that problem from their point of view. And then from that, we should be able to understand how we can better configure infrastructure so it makes it easier for the average citizen to switch to an electric vehicle, for example. And that basic pattern we could apply to many other types of case study. And that way we will start to get this sort of mindset shift that Tom was talking about. And we will start to learn how to really involve citizens in the delivery of infrastructure. But the key outcome of that kind of approach, which is known as a co-production approach, is that people convince themselves that a particular course of action is the right thing to do. And then they see other people who they trust and respect making similar decisions, and that actually gives them more confidence to make the decision themselves. So it's working in that way, I think, is where I advocate the infrastructure sector should be trying to move forward.
I suppose we shouldn't shy away from the fact that there's an awful lot of resources required to implement this change, and that's in terms of people and time, it's in terms of materials, and equally it might involve people putting, you know, their hands in their pockets and, for instance, putting in the infrastructure needed for EV charging points. That's going to come at a personal expense as well, isn't it, Colin? And David, I wonder if you could expand on perhaps where does that resource come from?
I'm not sure it's going to take that much more resource. It's just changing the way we do things, changing the mindset, as Colin was saying. That's very much us as citizens and the society that we're in. We start thinking about these things. There's plenty of people that deliver infrastructure. Have they got the mentality to say, okay, how do we do this towards net zero? How do we do it in a biodiversity and net gain situation? It's not that difficult to see how you can do it. I also think that the challenge that people perceive that it's going to cost more, you know, it's 2% of GDP to get to net zero. Again, I'm not convinced that's true either. History has told us that when technology has been deployed and it's incentivized through financial means, we've managed to deliver it. And in actual fact, it shouldn't be the case that we take finite resources, we process them, we throw them away, which is the society we live in at the moment. Surely we can have a society which actually, from an economic perspective, it is more economic to recirculate the materials that are in use. So that circularity point should be there. Whether the circularity takes place on a local basis, a regional basis, a national basis, or a global basis, doesn't really matter. Once things are in circulation, provided they keep being used and you can reuse them, we're not very good at doing that. And we haven't necessarily seen that. So I think if you take that, I don't think it's going to cost a lot. It's probably more changing people's hearts and minds that we need rather than additional resources.
And so that sort of circular economy piece, that's an important aspect of this jigsaw, if you like.
Absolutely, because if you think about it, at any point in history, lots of people are thinking about how we're going to live tomorrow. And I think the convenience that's brought us to have water on tap, to switch on and electricity happens, what's the next evolution of all of this? Well, it's actually living in a way which is living in the finite measure of the planet. That doesn't mean you can't have pleasure. It doesn't mean you can't go on holiday. It just means that most of the things we will do will have a circularity. So we won't use any more materials. We'll just use what's in place. It probably takes production mechanisms to change. That's fine. But I think it can be done. I think 28 years is probably reasonable for another industrial revolution. We've already gone through some of it in the last probably 10, 15 years. So I'm hopeful that that will achieve. I think ultimately, well, it'll have to be. If, as we've seen this summer, the climate gets progressively worse, more and more people will become attuned to the fact that this is a man-made problem, human-made. It needs human solutions to it.
Fantastic. David, you'll be aware that this podcast is called Beyond Brunel. What do you think we mean by beyond?
I think what we mean by beyond Brunel is that of his time, Brunel was an engineering genius who solved specific problems. I think the engineers of today and what we need to be training people is in what is the context in which we're delivering our projects. Because many of the issues that we face, climate, ecological emergency, are in part caused by quite a lot of the infrastructure we've delivered over many years. So the question I think we're asking ourselves is that what is our role as engineers being beyond Brunel? And I think it's very much to make clients aware, some of them their own pledges they've made, about how we deliver engineering and infrastructure beyond 2022.
We'd like to end each episode with some real-life inspiration. I'll therefore ask each of our guests to draw on an example of infrastructure or something contributing to infrastructure in the Southwest, something that's working really well and worth shouting about. David?
Net zero for new development is something that I think the government can implement by 2025. There's lots of good examples in the southwest of net zero developments that have happened. So we know that it's there. If you do that, that will, the value chain that Colin was talking about earlier in the podcast, that will take care of itself. But the government needs to create that chain. So we've given examples and we've shown it can be done at not much additional cost to developers. But implementing that would mean that all new development, and that would be something that we could bank for prosperity.
Miranda?
My example would be an exhibition that we've just created called Time is Running Out. It's touring the UK. It started off at Bristol Airport. Lots of examples that we're using today about the circular economy, about energy, water and transport are all covered in that exhibition. And it's just very accessible to young children. And we hope that that will inspire them and their families to get more engaged.
So our next generation is willing and waiting. David?
For implementation, net zero and all new development by 2025, Chris.
And Tom?
My example links into the circular economy concept that we've touched on a couple of times, and the fact that we're not particularly good at it at the minute. The European Environment Agency says that in 2019, only 12% of the material input to our economy was actually recycled or reused, still heavily dependent on utilising natural resources, burning them normally, and then they're gone. So they go as far as saying that 100% circularity is impossible. So one of the things, really practical examples, is just being better at recycling stuff. Technology clearly is helping us and it should progress. We need to get way better than that 12%. And you'd hope in 2022 that that figure is already a bit better. But I want to talk about the waste strategy that was implemented in Guernsey in 2018. Really nice example where by our recycling rate was good here at about 50%. We're talking about household recycling rate. And then we implemented a system in combination, hand in hand with constructing a new facility, a new processing facility, but introduced a user pay system with barcoded stickers that you put on bin bags. You've got to pay. Started off at £2.50 a bag. And within a year, our recycling rate had jumped to 72% of household waste, which is the best in Europe, if not potentially the best in the world. The UK national average is currently about 44%. So there's a lot of room for improvement. Now, it sounds like a very, very simple example. Clearly, that needs a bit of a shift in mindset. It needs legislation. It needs all sorts of stuff. But there's no reason why that couldn't be done in a year from now across the whole of the UK.
And Colin?
I have the privilege of being a trustee of the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which is a really interesting case study because the bridge is controlled by an Act of Parliament, which requires the trustees to manage the bridge in perpetuity. So we use the toll income to maintain the bridge so that it will last forever, essentially. That's the goal. Whether we can actually achieve that long term, we will see. But one of the things we've done is a carbon study of the bridge because we wanted to understand what its carbon footprint was. And what we discovered was that the carbon footprint of the bridge itself and its maintenance is quite small. But where we have a huge impact is when we close the bridge for maintenance and for safety reasons, when there are major events going on in Ashton Court near Bristol, and that the bridge is closed because of the number of people who might want to cross it. At that time, it drives up the carbon emissions in the city because the cars have to follow a longer route to get across the gorge. So it's a really interesting case study to indicate how we can learn how infrastructure works as a system where changing something of one part of the system can have a much more profound effect at a larger scale of the system. So closing the bridge drives up carbon emissions in the city. So that kind of learning, I think, is essential if we are to find more effective solutions in the future.
Fantastic. And it sounds like a really interesting role there, Colin.
It is. It's great fun and a great privilege.
Thanks to our guests, David Carter, Miranda Howsden, Colin Taylor and Tom Whitmore. You can find out more information about the Beyond Brunel podcast series and related research projects at southwestinfrastructurepartnership.co.uk. This podcast is supported by the Institution of Civil Engineers, Southwest.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.